day back in 2014, the Pet Shop Boys version of Always On My Mind was voted the top cover version of all time in a BBC music vote. The song, written by John Christopher, Mark James and Wayne Carson, was made famous by Brenda Lee and Elvis Presley in 1972. Johnny Cash's cover of Nine Inch Nails Hurt came second place, followed by the Stranglers version of Dionne Warwick's Walk On By. Never heard that. Also, Jimi Hendrix's take on Bob Dylan's Oil on the Watchtower came fourth. And who came five? Well, it was Jeff Buckley's cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. So, I'm not quite sure about the Always On My Mind by the Pet Shop Boys and Lady. I'm not a huge fan of that one, but they're really coming in through thick and fast. Here's one. The best cover version, says Carl, is Joe Cocker's With a Little Help from My Friends. Superb version done at the Woodstock Festival. And then, do you have a favourite cover version?
Yeah, I'm actually gutted that Jeff Buckley beat Katie Lang, because I don't know if you've heard Katie Lang's version of Hallelujah.
No.
It's almost close to Leonard Cohen.
That's just come in right now from Fiona in Christchurch. Hallelujah by Katie Lang. Fabulous, is
it? Yes, absolutely. It should be number one, as a matter of fact.
Oh, I've got to hear this. What about you, Patrick?
Oh, well, I've been rewatching The Wire and thinking that all those versions of Down in the Hole were pretty extraordinary.
Isn't that
my favourite,
fantastic?
Though, would have to be, would have, we're going to get in two here, is To Love Somebody by the Roberta Flack version of that. It's originally a Bee Gees song. She's just, she just nails it so gorgeously.
Yeah, and isn't that the theme song to The Wire just fantastic, and the way they do different versions?
Yeah, I love it. I love that whole tradition of songs from the American South, which are constantly reinterpreted.
Mm. Wallace, I direct you to the Northern Kings cover of A-ha's Take On Me. This is the Finnish power metal equivalent of a boy band covering an 80s classic. The Northern Kings did two full albums of wonderful power metal covers. Best cover, Wallace, Coldplay's Fix You by the Scary Pockets. So many coming through. Recent Titahi Bay says, I heard it through the grapevine by Creedence Clearwater Revival. And Nick says, best cover is Apocalyptia with Nina Harkins' version of Rammstein's Semen. In my humble opinion, says Nick. I guess part of it, just to expand on this theme, Nalini, is why the Pet Shop Boys won, Always On My Mind, because it was so radically different from Elvis Presley and Brenda Lee's version. They took it and made it their own, huh?
It's such a risk doing that, isn't it?
Exactly.
It could either fly or perform. I mean, Shelley Bass's version of Bringing the Clowns, have you heard that?
No.
So good. Yeah. It's, you know, if you're going to ask some, or if somebody decides to sing somebody else's song, and it's a really well-known song, particularly, you know, you've got to do it well.
Do it well, so and do it, but do it differently.
Yeah, and Pet Shop Boys did it.
Yeah, another one here, the best cover, Respect by Aretha Franklin, originally by Frank Sinatra. It's 24 to 5. The panel are NZ National. Lovely to have your company today. New Zealanders are frustrated at how government agencies are held to account with change needed to reconnect the public sector with those it serves, reports RNZ's Jill Bonnet. This from a discussion document from the Auditor General's office. One public sector interviewee told researchers public servants were not held to account in any logical fashion. Another described the system as clunky and siloed. And as for annual reports, interviewees saw them as compliance-driven, overly technical, not convenient or accessible, and not easily supporting public feedback or debate. So with us now to talk about this issue is Simon Chappell, who is the director of the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University. Simon, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace.
So are we well served by our public sector?
That is a glass half full, glass half empty question. I think the issue here is, can we make the public sector more accountable. And I think it's really good that the Auditor General is making contributions in this area. I guess I would have liked to have seen a broader consideration of accountability. But I don't think the state takes 30 cents in every dollar to spend, and we regulate across a huge range of human behaviours, ranging from consumer protection, interest rates, and even COVID lockdown zones. Accountability is incredibly important for such a powerful institution.
All right, let's get a bit black and white here. Annual reports, what do you think of them?
Absolutely fascinating issue. I got a bit of data on this, Wallace. I looked at the Public Service Commission's 2020 annual report, 118 pages, 32 colour photographs. Please explain to me what colour photographs have to do with institutional accountability. Now, I don't want to be picking on the Public Sector Service Commission here, so I looked at Victoria University's annual report, and equally 14 colour photos and 60 pages. Again, these days, annual reports are PR documents that try and sell the strategic decisions of the upper levels of the organisation to their stakeholders. They are not primarily about accountability. And I think that really needs to significantly change. And unfortunately, I don't think the Auditor General is across those set of issues.
How interesting. All right, Patrick Smalley, you first on this.
Where
do you start? Do you want to start with Nalini?
I'm happy to have a crack.
Go for it.
Yeah. I think there's a no surprises doctrine that runs in the public service now, which also means, I think, total risk aversion to anything. So the more you can wrap up your activity and process rather than apparent outcomes and in verbiage, the more safe you feel as an institution. I just think that's part of it, is that it's very hard to feel that a government agency is particularly interesting or relevant. And so I think accountability and relevance are sort of two sides of the same coin. And I just need to try a bit harder to actually talk to people about the things that matter to them rather than the things that matter to the agency. I don't think they're necessarily doing a particularly bad job in most cases. I just think that they don't do a very good job of telling us about it.
Simon?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, we've got a new Public Sector Act, and that Act has five principles and five values in it, and values like being politically neutral, offering free and frank advice. In terms of values, great values, being impartial, trustworthy, respectful, and so on. But there are no feedback loops through which we can hold the public sector account for meeting or failing to meet these principles. There's a lot of fine words, and it goes back to what Patrick said about verbiage. There's a lot of fine words in this space, but until we start collecting information on whether the public sector is living up to those principles and values, then there will be no accountability for those fine words.
Nalini Brook.
Simon, now those annual reports printed to go into awards programs, are they judged by any chance, are they? Those annual reports, the colourful annual reports, are they designed to be entered into an awards program? Are they ranked? Do they win something? Do you know? Or is it just me being a bit facetious here?
No, I don't. I suspect government departments have no idea who the readership of their annual reports is. But the notion that any but a very small minority of New Zealanders will read a departmental annual report has got to be questioned.
Now,
one thing that would help would be if the occasional select committee were to ask some decent questions.
Keep going, Lily.
Last question from me, Simon. How correct do you think is my perception that we see the public service as a resource that's available to government and that it is not really for the public? You know what I mean? We are not engaging with public servants. We're not engaging with the public service because the public service is really there as a resource for government.
Well, the public service is a very broad beast, and it is a resource for government in terms of policy advice, but it's a resource for you and I in terms of the health system, for example, or the education system. So it does this huge variety of things. I think Patrick's point about select committees, and it's raised in the Auditor General's report, is a really valid one. We have a very flat system. We have a unicameral parliamentary system. And so, you know, select committees are incredibly important in the New Zealand context in terms of holding the public sector to account. Yet, you know, and again, the point is made by the Auditor General that we have relatively few MPs and they're spread very thinly. So I do think there is a case for thinking of ways about how we boost the ability of select committees to scrutinise.
Hey, just finally, and some of your comments are actually pretty scathing, actually, Simon, in terms of what needs to happen. For example, looking at the wheel spinning, pointless meetings and people whose jobs aren't even justified. Does a public sector organisation have to have some sort of traffic light system? If it's working, it's green. If it needs to do better, it's orange. If it's a shocker, it's red.
Yeah. Look, it always needs to do better. I mean, you know, that's just the reality of any institution. I mean, there is a huge challenge here, as any public servant knows, that your days end up being filled with mindless meetings that come to the conclusion that you need to have another meeting. So, and that's a cultural thing. How do you change culture like that when you're not actually producing widgets and other sorts of outputs? That is the huge challenge that's incumbent on people trying to make the public sector more accountable for the
Very nice to have you on, Simon. Appreciate your insights. That's Simon Chappell, the Director of the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University. And if you are indeed in the public sector and you want to email me or text me anonymously about your quote-unquote pointless meetings, feel free to do so. Or, in fact, that you see a lot of value in what you are doing or what you're seeing.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, as there are some extremely hardworking public servants in the public service, I think it's very important we not undermine that, especially through the COVID times. There are some working extremely long hours to deliver us what they are.
Well said. Well said, Nalini. Kia ora.
And I've sat in some pretty boring private sector meetings, I can tell you.
Kevin says, and I agree with this, you should, regarding great cover versions of songs, you should see the Heart Sisters play Stairway to Heaven in front of Led Zeppelin at their induction into the Hall of Fame.
Oh, yes.
It is extraordinary. Go and see it right after after Checkpoint. no, in fact, when RNZ ends, because it is something, and whenever that is, and you will see Robert Plant in tears as the Heart Sisters play and sing Stairway to Heaven to him. It is really something to see. Another one, Whitney Houston.
I can second that, Wallace.
Isn't it beautiful? Whitney Houston.
It's beautiful. Yeah. He did wipe his eyes.
No, he didn't. The tears flowed, right? Wallace, yeah. The company I worked for paid for a PR person and photographer to fly from Auckland to inland South Island to get photos for the annual report. I'd hate to know the cost of that, says Hugo. It is 14 to 5. The panel, completely different topic. Auckland Council is seeking public feedback on a new bylaw which outlines where people can and cannot freedom camp in their vehicles across the region. It would designate 45 areas where freedom camping would be banned and 22 areas where it would be restricted, reports Adam Jacobson in SUF. With us is Auckland Waitakere Ward Councillor Linda Cooper, also Chairwoman of the Freedom Camping Bylaw Panel. Linda, kia ora.
Yeah, kia ora, Wallace, and tēnā kōrua to Patrick and Nalini.
Nice to have you on, Linda.
Thank
so,
you.
Looking at some of the general rules, proposed rules, what have we got here? They'll include all freedom campers staying in Auckland to use a certified self-contained vehicle. Another one is not returning to stay in the same parking area within 2 weeks. What do you make of the proposals?
Well, going back, we've got the Freedom Camping Act, and that's really permissive. It basically allows camping pretty much anywhere. Though there is the Reserves Act, which bans camping, so that's probably the only other control on that. And so we've had feedback from our Auckland community to say, look, and the Freedom Camping Act allows a bylaw. So they said, look, we'd like a bylaw. We want a bit more control. And we went through this process between 2017 and 2019, and it was a bit of a squib, unfortunately, because we didn't have a general rule in there, which was a bit of a misstep, a political misstep, not our bureaucrats. And I just want to support what Nalini says about how hard they work, local government and central government. So we've come back again and said, look, we'll put a general rule in. We need, you know, it's permissible for people to park on the side of the road, but our people say, look, we don't want them staying there forever. So let's have a general rule. And the proposal is two nights and get out by 9 o'clock in the morning, and have a self-contained vehicle, which is different from our last one because the government signaled that it's going to go that way. So we thought, well, we'll put that in now.
How big is the issue of freedom camping across Tamaki Makaurau and where you are specifically? What sort of things are you seeing?
Well, I mean, freedom camping, the definition of the effects are really things like environmental effects, access effects for locals to get into parks, littering, dumping waste, you know, sometimes noise from a campsite or cooking smells. I mean, an environmental, you know, can have the natural environment damage as well. But for the most part, these are the things that are outlined. They're the only things that we can take into account in the bylaw is a strict criteria if you're going to ban it. So for the most part, look, we don't have huge numbers of complaints, but of course, pre-COVID, we had about 320 camping vehicles a day on our roads in the February peak season. But of course, the trend's gone right down. But in general, there's not huge problems. Probably where the public get quite agitated is when people are living out of cars. And we know that's not people on holiday. Those are people who are experiencing homelessness. And we have other ways of dealing with that. We kind of have a graduated approach. We go in and say, look, seems you've got a bit of a problem here. How can we help? And if they're causing problems with litter, et cetera, we use the public safety and nuisance bylaw. So we've got other bylaws to deal with that. This is just to deal with people who are taking a break in their camper van. There's basically, and this is my personal view, having been through this whole process before and now doing it again, and listened to a lot of people in the last round of consultation, is there are genuine problems, but a lot of it is perceived, and a lot of it is kind of the high outrage, low harm.
Ah, right, yes. That comes with the freedom camping issue.
Yeah. And so there are issues, and we can deal with it. But without having a bylaw, we can't fine people.
Well, let's go. Yeah. Let's go to our panellists, because they might have views or questions on this too. Nalini, you first.
No, I'm pleased to hear that there are bylaws and that it has been communicated, because I think a lot of what happens is people aren't actually aware of what they can or can't do, or the facilities aren't available to them. So now if you say, well, you can't go freedom camping without your rubbish bins, without your portaloo, then it's just the way it is to be. It cannot be done.
That's right. The thing is, though, with the Freedom Camping Act, we can't ban it, because then we will be up for a legal challenge. So what we're trying to do here is, our community said we don't want the permissive nature, complete permissive nature of the Freedom Camping Act. We'd like a bylaw to come in underneath that and regulate it in some way better, you know, more than we have in the Freedom Camping Act. Local government has to follow the letter of the law. We can't do anything. We can't make something completely prohibited, because it would be in contravention of that act. So we've got to try and find a balance.
Sure.
And I think the thing is, with the general rule as proposed, I mean, I'm on the panel, I've got an open mind about it, I want to hear back again what people think. But last time when we didn't have a general rule, they said, you've got to have a general rule. We want some sort of guidelines as to how long people will be staying outside my house.
That's fair enough, isn't it, now, Patrick Smalley?
I think so. And it's one of those things, isn't it, where on the one hand, it feels to me as if freedom camping is almost like an extension of what New Zealanders expect to be able to do in New Zealand, which is to sort of go pretty much anywhere and camp there. What's
difficult is that, particularly when we had a lot more international tourists doing that as well, a lot of people just weren't considerate. You know, just have some manners. It's a bit like riding an electric scooter at the city. Just don't do it on the footpath in Queen Street when everybody's wandering around. You know, it's just a pity that we have to rely so much, apparently, on bylaws and regulation, when really good sense would tell you a lot of the time that you don't camp outside somebody's place forever, you don't tour in the bush, etc., etc., etc. I mean, how much, you know, some of this feels like learned helplessness. Yeah. Can't we just try and be adults about it?
Fair comments, Patrick.
Yeah,
and one says, Linda says, Wallace, get on to people who park their camper vans in suburban streets, especially narrow streets. They obstruct vision for people coming out of their driveways.
Yeah, I think we could be said for a lot of our parking with more high density in Auckland right now. It doesn't have to be a camper van. I think that's just part of... you know, the reality is, it is nice. What if Auntie Faye and Uncle Bert are coming from Hastings and they just want to park outside your house for a couple of days to visit you because you haven't got enough room in your house? And so there's those kind of things. And since we've had COVID, way more New Zealanders are camping. And if it's a self-contained vehicle, a lot of those issues around the toilet, etc., are much better. But this will give us a tool to find people who don't follow the rules.
Linda, thank you for your time. That's the Linda Cooper, the chairwoman of the Freedom Camping Bylaw Panel. Now, finally, this kind of follows on from yesterday, really, where Sir Dave Dobbin called out the unkindness, his view, the unkindness directed at those who aren't yet vaccinated. Should we retire the term anti-vaxxer and use some other words, perhaps alternative words? Many people use the term, although words like vaccine hesitant or unvaccinated could also work. Dr. Dougal Sutherland wrote about this. He's from the Victoria University School of Psychology. Dr. Sutherland, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace. Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you on, because it's a lovely segue from where we came into the conversation yesterday. Why do you think this term is so unhelpful?
Well, three main reasons. I think, firstly, it dehumanises people, so it creates them as just a group of others without really recognising them as people. Secondly, it creates an us and them, so it pits us against one another rather than against the virus. And thirdly, I think it sort of obscures the reasons why people might not have been vaccinated. And if you're not sure on the reasons, then it's fairly difficult to have a conversation with somebody, because there could be a multitude of reasons why people have not yet been vaccinated.
There are some who might say it creates an us and them between those who are vaccinated and those, the unvaccinated. Some might say, good, they deserve the label.
Well, yeah, I do kind of get that, but I don't think if we want to move a group of people towards getting vaccinated, or at least some of them getting vaccinated, I don't think you're really going to achieve the ends by dividing an us and them, because I think it just creates an in-group and an out-group, and the potential for animosity between the two, which I really don't think is going to be all that helpful for anybody.
What do you make of this, Patrick?
I think you have the patience of a saint, in the sense that I have to say I'm very, very sick, like everybody, of COVID-19, and completely over the absurd arguments that I keep hearing from people who are vaccine hesitant, unvaccinated, or in some cases are what I would call anti-vaxxers. I wouldn't retire the term. I'd just use it more carefully. There are some people who think that vaccines are, you know, the devil's spawn for a variety of odd reasons. I think it's an accurate term. There are lots of other people who aren't sure whether they want to be vaccinated or not, and it doesn't help to call them anti-vaxxers. I just think it would help if we all just maybe calmed down a wee bit. And this is one of the reasons I've got off social media. It's part of the whole let's get angry about everything with everybody mood that seems to be around at the moment. And so to that extent, I agree. Okay. I agree with you. But
you're going to keep using the term anti-vaxxer. All right, Dougal.
Yeah,
he's not going to stop.
Well, I think
I am going to be judicious.
Yes, he's going to be much more nuanced in his language. And I think it does require that judiciousness about sometimes it just gets under your skin and it makes you really annoyed. And those are probably not the times that you're going to have a productive conversation with anybody. And I think that using terms like anti-vax probably just fuel that, because, again, they dehumanise people and you stop seeing them as people and you start seeing them as the other who are preventing you from getting somewhere. And that might be true, but it's probably not going to help you, or it's probably not going to help them either.
Nalini, brief response from Nalini Baruch.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's time to drop that, because all we're doing is minimising their views. But I also want to say we must always remember that we sometimes have the most to learn from those that we disagree with.
Oh, what a lovely way to end the panel. Dr. Sutherland, kia ora, and Patrick Smalley, Nalini Baruch, thank you for your time. I'm Wallace Chapman, back 3:45 sharp. Lisa Owen with Checkpoint next. See you then.